some thief nabs your wallet and the $100 cash you had in it, you'll almost certainly tell the people who care about you. Nobody deserves to have their stuff stolen, right? And at the very least, you know, friends and family will sympathize. But if somehow you were scammed out of that same $100, you might not want anybody to know, because in addition to the sting of losing the money, it's just not socially acceptable to get conned. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Look, we've all been had at one time or another, but our particular response to being hustled is different from other kinds of victimization. It can make us not just more careful, but less generous, more vindictive, more resistant to compromise. Add together enough people trying hard not to get conned, and you end up with a culture that's downright mean. Tess Wilkinson Ryan is professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where she studies the psychology of decision making. Her book is called Foolproof: How Fear of Playing the Sucker Shapes Ourselves and the Social Order, and What We Can Do About It. Tess, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
I learned a new term reading this book, and I'm not even sure I'm going to pronounce it correctly. What is it sugraphobia, sugraphobia?
I think that you and I might be the first people to say this out loud. So I'm going to go ahead and say it's sugraphobia. I think the term was coined a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It means a fear of sucking, but I think fear of playing the sucker was what the authors who originally came up with that term envisioned.
And we all have that fear.
I think that's right. I think there's something relatively instinctive about it. And I think we also live in a culture with all kinds of reminders all the time about not taking any wooden nickels and fools born every day.
One of the things you've tried to understand with your research is why it feels so especially bad to be suckered. In many cases, our culture admires a clever swindler and assumes anybody who gets caught up in the scam is to blame for it.
Yeah, I think that part of the reason people dislike the feeling so much of being a sucker is it is a sort of a show of weakness a bit. So the person who gets stolen from, as you said, they don't like it. They don't enjoy having their being pickpocketed. But the person who gets scammed has sort of cooperated. Like they've taped their kick me sign to their own back, sort of. And so there's a bit of a status hit that you take when you voluntarily cooperate in something that's really bad for you. It suggests not only have you lost something material, say money or whatever it is, but that you've also been tricked, that you were foolish, and that's its own hit to the sort of the self-esteem and the role of the self in a social setting.
What's really interesting is the way this works when somebody takes advantage of a power imbalance. So somehow we think of Jeff Bezos as a genius for getting so rich, and we don't pay as much attention to what that means for his competitors or even his workers.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of familiar narratives that cast people who are working the system and are part of the system as geniuses or as doing, you know, sort of effective, maybe cost cutting, or as, you know, really savvy actors in the system. Whereas it's really intuitive to perceive and to resent things that seem like scams or hustles that are coming from peers or people who we believe in some particular situation to be kind of subordinates.
This plays out in some ways when we fail to read the fine print and we realize a deal we signed up for online or anywhere else isn't as good as we thought. No one ever says, well, that should have been made explicitly clear to me when I signed up. It's like it's our fault for not spending an hour and 45 minutes using a magnifying glass to try and understand what we've said yes to.
Yeah, this topic is especially close to my heart. I mean, every topic in this book is close to my heart, but I have to say I am a contracts professor in my day job. And so the issue of fine print is one that I've been thinking about for a long time. And I find it really beguiling, really interesting. And just to give you an example, at one point I was writing an article about, you know, how people think about the fine print in their contracts. And so I just did a quick survey of a bunch of sort of media hits where articles in various, you know, in the Wall Street Journal or in the Times or whatever that said there were stories about consumers who had failed to read the fine print and were now in some sort of trouble. And I was cataloging these stories, and the stories were so obviously about people who had been scammed in ways they could not possibly have prevented. And the titles of the stories would still be, you know, look what happens when you don't read the fine print, including one family that had put their stuff into a storage locker, and the storage locker owner had auctioned off their possessions.
Oh.
And it wasn't even part of the contract. There was just like a limited liability clause in the contract. But so obviously that's like illegal criminal behavior that the contract was not going to save anybody. And yet the framing, like, you know, you should have read the fine print was still so appealing for whatever reason.
So to make us feel better, all the rest of us, is it true that even contracts professors don't read every word of the fine print every time they sign off on something?
Literally never. I literally never read the fine print. I will say, it's not that I don't ask follow-up questions of the salesperson or do some market research before I buy stuff. But listen, I have not eaten lunch yet today, and I've probably not read the fine print on 7 contracts already. Just because I'm a human in the world, right? And I couldn't possibly. The volume is too high.
So some of this comes down to human psychology, right? So how does getting played mess with our sense of self?
Yeah, I think that there is a distinctly social element to feeling suckered. It feels like a social demotion. It feels like a, you know, if you think about the expression, someone has put one over on you, I think that's we understand that to be a synonym for getting fooled. But I think it also has, there's a literalness to it. Someone has put one over on you, and now you're under.
Hmm.
Such that the way that some sort of scam or grift works out is that the scammer or the grifter is on top, and they have put down the person who they have fooled. And that means that being fooled or being scammed has really intense personal, like, psychological implications, because people hate that kind of hit to their status or their dignity, right? That's a really big deal. Oftentimes that's the bigger deal than whatever it is that they actually lost. I'll also say that there's a pretty interesting body of research about the ways that people feel about the ways that people interact with the feeling of regret. And you really regret things where you yourself played a role, where there's some blame that you have for your own behaviors. That's what leads to regret. And getting scammed is a case where you really do have regret, because you have done something to participate in this scenario in ways that you haven't if you've just been sort of randomly targeted.
So if we've been taken once or more than once, we tend to set these guardrails up around ourselves that make us reluctant to trust anybody else. How can that level of suspicion that, you know, we take on to protect ourselves, how can it actually cause problems for us?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question, and one that sort of motivated this whole project was the idea that being really vigilant or really wary of scams can actually be counterproductive. So there's a study by a couple of psychologists at Stanford, very straightforward study. They just asked a bunch of participants, imagine if you had $100 to invest in a startup, and here's what you know about this startup that you could invest in. You know that there's an 80% chance that nothing much happens, and you just break even, basically. They just give you back your money, and that's the end of it. There's a 15% chance that you double your investment, and there's a 5% chance you lose everything. Now, that's a pretty good investment in the sense that your odds of doubling your money are 3 times the odds of losing everything. So it's kind of attractive. But they divided the participants in the study into 2 groups and gave each group a different piece of additional context about that downside risk. In one group, they said the 5% possibility of a downside risk here is the risk that the founders of the company have overestimated the market demand for this product that we're making. In the other group, they said the 5% risk here is a risk that the founders of this company are actually total frauds. They're fraudsters. And then they asked everybody, okay, how much of your $100 would you want to invest in the company given these odds? The people who thought that there was just regular market risk said, like, around $60 of my $100 I would be willing to put in. And the people who heard that there was going to be, there was a 5% chance of being scammed were only willing to invest like $37. So like less than two-thirds of the amount of the other group.
Even though the conditions didn't change, the conditions around which
exactly.
they could win or lose money. Okay.
Exactly. Hmm. So the numbers are the same. I read that study as a pretty strong suggestion that the people in the scam condition, in the fraudster condition, are underinvesting. Because in an investment situation, usually your goal is just to make money. Like that's the thing you're doing, right? The only real thing that you're, the only real sort of value at play would be, I would like to increase my initial investment. And so it doesn't seem quite right to me that there's something materially different about being taken for a ride by some fraudsters than there is about just losing it all because of a mistake. But people still make that distinction pretty strongly.
So as you've said, Tess, regret is a really powerful emotion, and taken to its extreme, it can really distort the way we make decisions. And one example that comes up in the book is people who, we've known these people, they go broke paying divorce lawyers to be sure their ex doesn't get more than they think they should, even when maybe there would be more for both parties if they didn't engage in all this costly litigation.
Yes, if there's one thing that I know as a contracts professor is that people who feel taken advantage of, who will respond oftentimes with such strong emotion or a sense of indignation that it really affects their willingness to basically expend a lot of resources of their own in order to sort of extract some punishment. I think in the divorce context, this is true, but also it's true in the contracts context. I teach the first year contracts course to law students, and sometimes we're talking about a case and we're sort of far down our conversation, and somebody will raise their hand and be like, wait a minute, are you telling me these people are spending thousands of dollars on litigation over a contract that was probably worth like $200 max? Like they're pouring money into the fight in order to insist, you conned me out of this money. You breached this contract. You betrayed me. And they want the court to sort of vindicate their anger in ways that have become totally untethered from their actual losses in the deal.
What do we know about the influence of greed as a motivator in deal making as compared with the influence of fear?
That's a super interesting question. So when I was in graduate school, which is like 15 years ago, when I was in graduate school, we talked a lot about the influence of greed on decision making. And we were talking about two kinds of goals that people might have that would be intention. They would have the goal of being generous or caring or having sort of other regarding preferences, how we describe them. And then you have the goal of your own material self-interest, greed. And so we would be trying to explain what's going on in various kinds of studies by saying, well, look, here are participants in this study, and you can see that they are, some of them are generous and some of them are greedy. But there was a third explanation that would come up sometimes that was really interesting, and that was partially why I started to get interested in suckers. And that third explanation was, what if some people who look like they're greedy are actually fearful? It's not that they're trying to come out on top, but they're trying to make sure that they don't come out on bottom if everybody else is going to act greedy. So there's a really interesting set of studies from, say, the late 70s, early 80s called, it's a bunch of games. And this one particular game is called the public goods game. And some researchers who were running this public goods game in an experimental laboratory were able to try to tease out whether or not the people playing this game were fearful of being suckered or were most focused on being greedy. And so here's how they did it. They've got four players in a game, and each of the four players is told the following rules. You're going to get $10 each, and you can take any of your $10 and put them in the common pot. Whatever gets put in the common pot, we're going to multiply. We're going to put 1.5 times whatever's in the common pot and then distribute it evenly among the four players. Now, you four players aren't going to meet each other. You're all going to be in different rooms. You won't see each other, but you're going to know what everyone else's decision is simultaneously with your own. Now, if you play that game, say, 5 or 6 rounds with the same players, what you'll see is that people start donating less and less. So, in theory, the best outcome for everybody, like the joint best outcome, is everyone donates $10. That means the pot gets 40, it gets multiplied, so it becomes 60, it gets redivided, so everybody goes home with 15. So, by cooperating, they increase what they go home with by $5. Of course, any individual who wants to stay out of the game, sorry, who wants to dominate the game, might try to hold their money back. Because best case scenario, I hold my $10, everybody else donates their whole $10. Then the amount in the pot, the $30, gets multiplied to 45, and that $45 gets divided by four. So I get my $10 that I started with plus a quarter of the pot, which means I get over $20. So I win. If you play over and over again, you'll see people donating less and less and less because and everybody it eventually ends with everybody only not donating anything. Everyone just keeps their $10 and goes home. And the question was, why is this happening? Is everyone trying to come out on top? And everyone tries to come out on top, and then it means that there is no public good to share? Or is it happening because people actually want to share? They want the group outcome to be good, but they're afraid they're going to be the only one who's being cooperative, and that's going to feel terrible. So the researchers asked the players, hey, but when you tell us how much you're donating, tell me also what you think everybody else is going to do. And the interesting finding was the people who donated the most were the people who thought everybody else was also going to donate a lot. That's important because if the motive was greed, then the people who think everybody else is going to donate a lot should be the ones to hold their money back and take advantage of the and take advantage of the of everybody else's generosity. So it was an interesting way of saying, look, here we can see that actually when people believe that there is cooperation, they're less worried about being suckers and they're more willing to cooperate. It's not so much greed driving their behavior here, it's fear.
So the more we trust the people around us, the better we'll behave and the better everybody else will do.
Exactly. No, there was a great article called something like "The Sucker Is the Savior." That was like a sort of a follow-up on these games, and basically showed if you have one person who just keeps cooperating no matter what, that person will actually drive up the total amount of cooperation because people sort of need to see somebody else who's also in it with them cooperating and trusting in order to be willing to put themselves on the line.
Okay, so I want to go back to this idea of a Jeff Bezos-like figure. Anybody in a position of great power who vastly profits off people with far less privilege and money, we often barely notice, let alone object to that kind of top-down exploitation. But boy, the flip side of that is that we are blinded by outrage when we feel like somebody who exists on a lower rung is getting away with something. Talk just about how that might play into objections many working class Americans have to public assistance programs or what used to be called welfare.
So here's the idea. The idea is that people don't feel as bad about being taken advantage of by institutions or other people who have sort of more political or social capital than they do. In part because that kind of exploitation, this is that exploitation in theory, is just sort of reinforces the existing hierarchy, essentially. Right? So, in the same way that I, as a professor in a university, don't have like, I'm not particularly worked up if people with bigger jobs than mine in the university have higher salaries, right? Because I sort of understand there's a hierarchy and I'm not at the top of it, which is fine. Where the idea is that when people see their peers or people who they thought were sort of behind them in line, gaming the system, they are particularly reactive in part because it makes them seem like the sucker. And one of the ways of thinking about this is that if I'm taken advantage of by somebody who I think of as sort of my employee or my kid or my student or whatever, if I'm taking advantage of somebody who has a lower role in some particular hierarchy, it kind of means that I am moved further down the ladder because I'm now below them in some sort of status conscious way. I'll just say here, I think it's pretty uncomfortable. I think especially maybe for Americans to talk about status in this way. And in part, that's probably why a lot of this plays out in this implicit way rather than being something we're talking about explicitly. But I want to suggest that people often understand status at a pretty instinctual level, and they have it in mind. There was a second part to your question that I just want to make sure I don't lose track of, which is about the question of how this would play out in terms of public assistance. I read this really striking description in the book Strangers in Their Own Land. And the anecdote maybe helps to describe this particular thing. So it was about a working class couple who would donate every winter to a Christmas toy drive for local children. And they would go to this, they would go to their church or neighborhood association where there were requests basically on different slips of paper for specific kinds of toys or clothes or whatever needy families in the community had asked for. And specifically it was for children. And the anecdote the description described this family sort of talking through how they did this donating, keeping in mind this was charity from people who were really going way out of their way. They themselves did not have extra money. It was not like a disposable income situation. And they said, we go and we look through what these different kids are asking for and choose some to give to, but we'll take out anybody, for example, who suggests that they need kids' shoes that are a big size, because we think that those might just be adults trying to sort of game this system and get extra stuff from this kid's toy drive. So that was a really remarkable example, because these are people who are going way out of their way to help other people in their communities, families going way out of their way, but they're constrained by their real concern that any kind of helping is actually them being taken advantage of, so much so that they're screening out, like, you know, big-footed children for fear that maybe an adult would accidentally receive help.
How can our fears about playing the fool contribute to social ills like racism?
One of the insights of social psychology that I found really compelling over the years of thinking about these issues and a little bit of studying them is that racism, sexism, group stereotyping, and prejudice is not just contentless animus. It's not just dislike or distrust. Stereotypes have content to them. And one of the things that I found while I was really trying to think about what role fear of playing the sucker has in society is I started really thinking about what the content is of stereotypes, especially racial and ethnic stereotypes. And a lot of that content refers directly to accusations that people of other races or ethnicities are trying to fool us, trying to take advantage, or themselves are sort of hapless suckers who sort of deserve some sort of maltreatment. So the stereotypes are these sort of pernicious views that whole groups of people ought to be understood as either suckers or schemers. And it means that when you invoke certain kinds of stereotypes, it's sort of naturally invoking a set of accusations that people implicitly take seriously, or parts of their brain are sort of attuned to these ideas, like, oh, wait, maybe I'm about to be taken advantage of.
It's so interesting that there is, like, at the same time, this desire to portray people who are discriminated based on race as naive fools, and also to portray them as people who are trying to get away with something. I mean, it doesn't seem like those things should fit together in our brains.
I know. It's kind of like this classic double bind, or I think of it as if you are a marginalized group, one of the things about these sucker narratives is that you're essentially having to walk along this incredibly narrow tightrope, where any behavior that deviates to this on the sort of side of savviness is viewed as exploitative, and any behavior that's potentially taken as advantage of sort of incompetence, taken to look like incompetence, is suddenly evidence that, in fact, this group is playing the fool.
Tess, how do our fears about being suckered affect our motivation to work collaboratively with people on our teams?
I think this is one of the big costs of being super wary of being fooled, and it's the cost of being unwilling to cooperate. So I think anyone who's been part of a group project has probably experienced this feeling where you're working really hard, you think that this group, that this project is important, but then you start to think, am I the only one doing any work around here? And you start to have the urge to just disengage, not do it anymore, even though you otherwise care about the outcome.
Is there something we can do to get over this? I mean, it's sort of like all the problems where we decide, in a blind situation, how much money we want to put into the collective pot. How can we know, that we're not just wasting our effort?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with what the ultimate goal is. You raised this interesting idea at the beginning of this conversation about the idea that some people might say, "Well, I'm gonna stop working, basically on principle." And I think that that's a particularly interesting paradox in the group work context, which is that sometimes what you have is people say, "Look, I'm the only one doing any work anymore. This isn't fair. I'm going to basically slack off on principle." Even in cases where ultimately the project has real value to them, and where there is something a little bit funny and a little bit perverse about the idea of slacking off on principle, right? Usually those are understood to be sort of things that would be exactly against your principles about like hard work and cooperation. The ways that people can kind of counteract some of those urges to stop cooperating is just to evaluate them as explicitly and straightforwardly as possible. If I'm in a group and I realize nobody else here is even doing any of this work, I'm just sitting on this committee and I'm taking notes and I'm writing memos, and everybody else is essentially like checking their email or has kind of checked out from this whole enterprise. And I start to think to myself, you know what? Forget it. I'm out of here too. The thing that probably makes a difference for me is asking myself, wait a minute, what are my actual goals here? And is it actually not worth it to me to do this work? Because the answer to that question is what sort of deserves my real attention. So oftentimes you think I'm on a, let's say I'm on some sort of a team that's where I feel like I'm doing a lot of work. I might think to myself, I am doing more work than other people, but the amount of work I'm doing is still the right amount of work for me because of how much I value the outcome. I want this outcome. This outcome was always worth this amount of work. So whether the thing that I'm doing is, say, building some new program in the curriculum, or I'm trying to, hire someone to come to the law school, something like that. And I think to myself, okay, wait a minute. Maybe I'm mad about some internal dynamics, but still, I want this thing to happen. And I want it so badly that it's worth it for me to do everybody's work.
We do have some choices about how we'll respond to the sense that we've been taken. Can you explain self-cooling?
Yes. Yes, I can. There's an old article by Irving Goffman, who was a sociologist in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. And Goffman wrote this great article called On Cooling the Mark, On Cooling the Mark Out, sorry. And On Cooling the Mark Out. And the idea was that he was describing in this very sort of like, kind of like hip gangster lingo of like the late 50s, was that what happens when the sort of mob runs a scam on you is that they send one gangster out later to sort of tell you you've been scammed, and to help you basically acclimate to that feeling of being scammed, to help you figure out a story you're going to tell yourself that's going to make this okay. And what Goffman said was, this is kind of an allegory for how we get through life all the time and manage various feelings of failure. And so one of the things I was talking about that I thought about in the context of writing about suckers was, it's not the case that every single story, every single slight we take really hard. There are actually plenty of times when things are not going well and you say to yourself, well, I guess I am kind of the sucker in the situation, and it's no big deal. Or you say to yourself, I don't think that this is a scam at all. I think this is actually totally legit and I'm fine with it. Or you say to yourself, I guess I'm the only person here who has the morals that help that, that tell them to keep cooperating or whatever the thing is. So the idea of self-cooling basically is the idea of talking yourself out of getting really worked up about some situation in which you've been potentially, you could potentially feel like a sucker.
Tess Wilkinson Ryan is professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where she studies the psychology of decision making. Her book is called Foolproof: How Fear of Playing the Sucker Shapes Ourselves and the Social Order and What We Can Do About It. Tess, this is really remarkable stuff. Thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts by looking for KERA Think, or you can listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.